Good afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly magazine of most things culturally considered. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, I'll be talking with playwright Anthony Clairvaux of the Aurora Theater about the world premiere of his play, Our Practical Heaven. And two violin virtuosi join me in studio. Gene Johnson of the early music ensemble Music of the Spheres shares details about their upcoming concerts, which are being billed as a Valentine from the French Baroque. Canadian violinist James Ennis, who's been called the Heifetz of our day, is featured in San Francisco Symphony Concerts this week. He'll be here this hour as well. Now, I'm not really a football fan, but speaking of the San Francisco Symphony, there's a fun Facebook rivalry going on between the Baltimore and San Francisco Symphonies before the hour's out. I'll prove to you that the Symphony in the land of the 49ers is vastly superior to the Symphony where the Ravens nest. Let's begin, though, with Music of the Spheres. First guest is violinist Gene Johnson, whom you heard there performing The Ground After the Scotch Humor by Nicola Mateis. Gene Johnson is made her solo debut with the orchestra at age 11, won first place in the Milwaukee Symphony Youth Soloist Competition at 16, and her love of music was fanned by three wonderful summers at Interlochen Arts Camp in Michigan, went on to receive music degrees from Indiana University and the New England Conservatory. In addition to being the founder of the ensemble Music of the Spheres, which has performances this weekend in Palo Alto, San Francisco, and Berkeley, and performing with a number of Baroque and early music ensembles, she's equally comfortable on the modern violin. She's toured with Vince Gill and Amy Grant, performed with the Nashville Chamber Orchestra, which is a crossover multi-style orchestra with the most new music commissions in the United States. Gene, I welcome you to KALW.
Thank you so much.
How did the music ensemble, Music of the Spheres, come about?
Well, I actually met them at different festivals in different parts of the country. Yuko Tanaka, a harpsichordist, and I were both at the Carmel Bach Festival. And Joanna Blendelf and I are both alumna of Indiana University from different times, and we met at the Bloomington Early Music Festival. And during that era, my former husband and I had been thinking of moving to the Bay Area, where they were both living. And I remember thinking what a dream team it would be if that came to pass. It didn't. And I thought, well, why let a little thing like being across the country, you know, postpone our plans? And so we did our first concert as a fringe concert at the Berkeley Early Music Festival in 2000.
And what drew you to Baroque music, working on Baroque music as opposed to the modern repertory?
I was really drawn to Stanley Ritchie's program at Indiana University, which was, their concerts were just incredible. And that was when I first got drawn into it. And later it was kind of a duh moment for me to realize I was a broke violinist. I'd always loved music from, even earlier music from medieval times, Renaissance. Loved history from that era. And I love the, there's a freedom with it and the ornamentation and improvisatory nature even of some of the early compositions that I find much more freeing, maybe a little more like jazz might be.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. I was wondering if there are particular challenges that you are faced with performing on authentic instruments versus their modern counterparts. Now, after all, some of the most finest modern instruments are actually dating from the 1700s. So how are the Baroque instruments different from what one would hear in a standard orchestra?
The violins, you know, originally the Stradivarius, et cetera, were Baroque instruments, and they were, quote, modernized in the 1850s, probably. The differences are the strings are gut. They're not wound in silver. The fingerboard is shorter because they didn't have to play quite as high as we do now. The tension is lighter. The fingerboard, tailpiece, and bridge underneath the strings are all thinner. And the bow, of course, is just drastically different. It, you can really see how the bow is named after the bow and arrow.
Now,
so the tension's
now
different.
I have a pet peeve about people using the word, of course, on the radio. Now, what makes the bow different from a modern bow?
It's shaped in a tapered effect like a bow and arrow.
Oh, okay.
And it's lighter. It has less hair, which is the part that we play on.
Mm-hmm.
So it's attack on the string. It's decay of a note on the string is vastly different from the modern bow, which was redesigned for the big halls of the 1800s.
I see, yes.
The big forces in the orchestras, the desire to sustain and get a very molassesy, deep, almost operatic type of sound versus the transparent sound.
That also contributes to the evolution of the strings, and the composition of the strings on the Baroque instruments are very different. Tell us about the strings of
exactly.
of Baroque instruments.
They are actually gut from sheep gut, usually wound, and some of the thicker strings are wrapped in silver. Today, most of them have synthetic cores. Some of them still have real gut cores, but they're all wrapped in metal. So there are pros and cons to that. It's much, much easier to have a squeak on a Baroque violin string that's a little beyond your control. But I think there's much more richness in it, like a fine wood grain that's varied, and the modern strings are a lot more homogeneous across.
And does it present particular tuning challenges then, as opposed to modern strings that are metal?
Yes, they tend to get out of tune a little more easily, and of course we're changing our A's that we tune to change pitch depending on the era and the composer. So currently a modern symphony would tune to at 440 hertz a second, and we might do 415, 430, 392. So they're moving around a lot pitch-wise.
This program is called Toujours l'amour, French Baroque music, music of the spheres. How did the name Music of the Spheres, how did you devise the Music of the Spheres name?
I actually wrote a paper on Boethius when I was in grad school, or in undergrad, who was a medieval monk that developed some of the first music theory concepts. And he wrote an essay about music. They viewed music very differently in the medieval era, not only instrumental music, but they viewed the body as having a type of music or harmony with the humors of the era that they thought, you know, made up our body. And then the planets and orbits and sense of harmony out in space. And they viewed each as a microcosm of the other. So that it was a very much broader concept, probably more the way we would view the word harmony today. And I really feel that music has a lot of healing power. And I was struck very much by that idea. Scientifically inaccurate as it is, I think it hit a truth. And music is it's a safe, anonymous form that bypasses words and can really get right to the soul of things, right to the heart of things.
There are a lot of new studies out that show how music is very effective in stimulating the minds of patients with Alzheimer's.
Yes. Yes.
Fascinating stuff going on with music. There's so much we don't know about what areas of the brain that music stimulates and not only helps, but helps develop.
Yes.
The concert is being billed as a Valentine from the French Baroque. Tell us about the composers involved.
We have some well-known and possibly some lesser-known composers. François Couperin, Rameau, Jean-Marie Leclerc, who wrote some of the first French violin sonatas. A female composer, Elizabeth Claude Jacquet de la Guerre, is being featured as well. Marin Marais, whom some people may know from the movie Tous les Matins du Monde. And we decided, because of the timing of the program, to turn it into a Valentine, early Valentine program. So we're actually interspersing some quotes about love from various French authors in between the pieces.
Oh, very nice. In English or French?
I toyed with the idea and decided to go with English.
Okay. I'm talking with Jean Johnson. She, along with Joanna Blendolf and Yuko Tanaka on harpsichord, is Music of the Spheres. Their concerts are tomorrow in Palo Alto, Saturday in Berkeley, and Sunday in San Francisco. I'd like you to talk a little bit about your other endeavors aside from the world of music. I understand you also were a classical music announcer at one point.
Just a lowly fill-in sub-host for the NPR classical station in Atlanta. I usually took the shifts that nobody wanted, like 7 o'clock Sunday morning and Friday and Saturday night.
Guilty as charged myself in my career for starting out.
And I'd be alone in the studios, and I just loved it. I loved it. But it's very stressful. I think people don't always know you have to time things down to the second to catch the NPR feeds. And even now, if I'll hear some of the music at the end of a show, I'll start to adrenaline run, even though it's been several years.
And of course, you must have had the anxiety dreams about pressing the wrong button or being late to the studio, as everyone has.
Yes, indeed. Sometimes they came true, too.
Tell us about your fellow performers.
Joanna Blendolf plays both Baroque cello and gamba. She was the recipient of a prestigious performer certificate at Indiana University and travels quite a bit around the country performing. She currently lives in Eugene, Oregon. Yuko Tanaka is a very gifted harpsichordist, forte pianist, also a pianist. She teaches piano, has her doctorate from Stanford, and performs very, very extensively in the Bay Area.
These concerts, Music of the Spheres, once again, Friday in Palo Alto at the First Lutheran Church on Homer Avenue, Saturday in Berkeley at St. John's Presbyterian, and Sunday here in San Francisco at St. Mark's Lutheran, a beautiful venue. I don't know if you've played there before.
I have.
It's very nice. Tickets are available through sfems.org. Let's hear some more of your music from this lovely CD that you brought called Music of the Spheres. We're going to hear a cut by Bieber. Tell us about this piece.
There are two on that. Is it the Passacaglia?
Sonata number one, I believe you suggested.
Okay. In A major. It's rather wild, early stuff from the 1600s. It sounds a little bit like a precursor to, honestly, some of the bluegrass music we have, most of which came out of the English tradition, but you'll be surprised at what you hear in it. You can hear a definite trend towards that.
Jean Johnson, Joanna Blendolf on Baroque cello, and Yuko Tanaka on harpsichord. Jean playing violin. It is Music of the Spheres. Jean, I thank you for taking some time coming in today. Here is music of Bieber.
Thank you. Thank you.
Music of the Spheres. Gene Johnson, violinist. Joanna Blendolf, viola da gamba, and Yuko Tanaka, harpsichord. And that work by Heinrich Ignaz Franz von Bieber. Music of the Spheres is presenting a concert called A Valentine from the French Baroque tomorrow in Palo Alto, Saturday in Berkeley, and Sunday in San Francisco. Details about that concert at sfems.org. You're listening to Open Air. I'm David LaTulippe. My next guest, Anthony Clairvaux, is an award-winning playwright and San Francisco native who has been roaming the country, writing plays, and raising a family. I'm not sure how that equation works with the roving and the raising a family, but we'll find out shortly. His play, Show and Tell, recently played to rave reviews in San Francisco in a production by the newly formed Symmetry Theater Company, and his most recent play, Our Practical Heaven, was one of the winners of the 2011 Global Age Project at the Aurora Theater. It's now in development, playing through March 3rd. Anthony, welcome back to KALW.
It's great to be here, David.
Now, this recent work, Our Practical Heaven, ties in quite nicely with what's in the news these days, more and more climate change. And it concerns three generations of a family who gather over three holidays in a home none of them expects to long survive the rising sea. Can you tell us a little bit more about your interest in climate change and how it worked into the play?
I really became aware of how pervasive the influence of climate change was when I began hanging around with birders, stand in a crowd of people with binoculars in Central Park in New York, and they would say things like, how can you have a least favorite warbler when you think of all they went through just to get here? And one of the things that the warblers were getting through with increasing difficulty was stronger storms, stronger winds, stronger rains, more hurricanes, and an environment for which they were ill-adapted. And just as the birds were having to change their behaviors or perish, the birders were aware that the world around them was changing years before this became part of our national conversation. That alone made them interesting to me as forward-thinking people, but they also have a language and a passion of their own. I thought, there's something here, there's some drama here. And discovering that a group of these people could be also a family of characters whose stories I had been thinking about for a while and trying to find a theme for, a place for, made it all, so to speak, dovetail.
The Global Age Project addresses changing tides. Now, tides specifically work into this play of yours, but it also the changing tides of communications and how a family is defined.
Absolutely. Once I realized that this was a story about three generations of a contemporary family, I realized that in order to tell the truth about what was going on and what is increasingly going on in a world where the future is looking different from the present and is coming faster than we ever expected, one of the factors is that the generations are communicating with each other very differently. So part of the fabric of the play is not just real-life conversations the characters are having with each other, but also projected over their heads are texts and posts that they're exchanging with each other. We also get to see dreams and visions that they're having as well, and those conversations that they can't actually quite literally have, which are so frequent between parents and children.
So not only the way that people are communicating is changing and evolving, or in some cases devolving, but the very definition of a family has changed significantly.
Absolutely. I've seen this across the country, and of course very much here in the Bay Area and very much in the arts. We do form new families. Many of us are the black sheep of our own families, and so we form whole families of black sheep, where people say, I care for you, I want to be, you know, in a family with you. I adopt you. I partner with you. And this is very much happening in the world of the play as well. But the question is, now that this is happening, as people age, as the structure of a family changes, how will that new kind of family endure?
I'm wondering about the arc of the play. Now, this is set over three different holiday periods where they know that they may not have this home again due to some rising tides. First of all, is this set in a specific place? Are we going to see, you know, Joe's Clam Shack from Cape Cod in the background or something from Bolinas? Or how are you setting it?
It really is based on people and experiences that I had being with families and birding on all four coasts of America. I didn't want to be too specific to any one location, frankly. It's on the border between the ocean and the land. It's on that in that kind of gray area between dreaming and waking, between the present and the future.
And I'm wondering, this family who realizes they may not have this place anyway, is there a sense of transition, of despair, or just acceptance?
Each of the characters is approaching the change they see coming in a different way, based on the issues they're tackling, based on their own strengths and weaknesses. Yes, for some, it's, you know, they're ready to fly the coop. For others, they're ready to sit down and brood.
Tying in with birds once again. That's the birds, by the way, which know no borders.
Indeed.
And yet are affected severely by the world's climate change.
Absolutely. One of the striking things that you see as the environment is changing, as species are having to evolve, the notion of what constitutes your flock is changing very much. And this seemed just to resonate very much with how people are dealing with their own change in environment.
Tell me a little bit about the actors you've assembled for this play.
Well, one of the extraordinary opportunities that working with the Aurora on this project has afforded me is the chance to work with the same core company of actors for the 2 years that the project has been in development there, since our first reading in the Global Age Project, through workshop, through staged reading. Alan McKelvey, the director, has been a presence and a collaborator throughout, and the cast is headed by three of the most beloved and gifted actresses in the Bay Area. Joy Carlin plays the matriarch of this family. Annie Dara plays her daughter. Julia Brothers plays her honorary daughter. And then three remarkable rising actors are playing their daughters.
Great to be working with people that you know what you can get from them. That's nice.
Absolutely, where there's some history, the shared history among them, and the history as well of my seeing their work, including their work in place of mine.
I understand you also teach the next generation of budding playwrights. Has the current flock, shall we say, keeping with the bird analogy, responded to things differently? Or do you see them writing in a different voice than you've heard before?
Well, yes. One of the things that's striking, fortunately, in the work that I'm doing with writers is many of my newer writers are actually at Stagebridge, a theater company in Oakland dedicated to seniors. So some of my new writers are in their 80s and 90s. They are extraordinarily courageous. They know no shame or fear and write from a marvelously broad and deep perspective. I'm also working with people at the Playwrights Foundation in San Francisco, which is an extraordinary institution that was very young when I left town a generation ago. Now that I'm back, it is nationally known, as is the Aurora Theater. And it's part of a growing sense that the Bay Area is a national capital of new plays and new theater.
And again, your play, Our Practical Heaven, part of the Global Age Project at the Aurora Theater. Anthony, thank you for spending a little bit of time. Anthony Clairvaux, playwright's work, Our Practical Heaven, is having its world premiere as we speak. Runs through March 3rd at the Aurora Theater in Berkeley. Season 21 of the Aurora. Information at Aurora Theater, that's theater with an R-E, auroratheater.org. Anthony, thank you so much for taking some time.
Thank you, David.
Still to come on Open Air, Diane Keogh will offer some cultural picks and reviews, and I'll share the Facebook rivalry of the San Francisco Symphony and Baltimore Symphonies on the eve of the Super Bowl, and more violin music.
Thank you.
That's a recording of my next guest giving his Stradivarius a workout at our sister station, WQXR, in New York, and Bach's Partita No. 3. The Manitoba-born violinist James Ennis is featured soloist this week with the San Francisco Symphony. He's performing Lalo's Symphonie Espagnole with Charles Dutoit, conducting a program that also includes Ravel's Rhapsody Espagnole and Elgar's Enigma Variations. James was the youngest musician to win first prize in strings at the Canadian Music Festival in 1988. The following year, at the ripe old age of 13, he made his orchestral solo debut with the Montreal Symphony, graduated from the Juilliard School, made his San Francisco Symphony debut in 2003 as a soloist in Kurt Weill's Violin Concerto, returning most recently in 2010. James was also the youngest person ever elected fellow to the Royal Society of Canada and has been appointed member of the Order of Canada in 2010. Quite an honor, eh? I'm pleased that he's taken some time to join us prior to tonight's concert with the symphony out at the New Green Center at Sonoma State University. James, welcome to KLW.
Thank you very much.
Now, tell us about the Lalo Symphonie Espagnole that you'll be playing with the symphony. Oh, actually, you had a performance last night in Davies Hall.
Right, yeah, we had the first concert last night, and as you mentioned, we're out in Sonoma tonight, and then another one at Davies on Friday. It's a fantastic piece. It's such fun to play it, and it's one of those pieces that I think was so popular in the last century, sort of in the middle of the last century. It became so popular that people stopped playing it, and amazingly, it's been quite a while since the San Francisco Symphony has programmed it, so it's great to, and it's been kind of a while since I've played it, actually. It's probably been 5 or 6 years, so it's great to get back into this music. You know, the violin has such a rich repertoire of these romantic, they're perfectly written for the violin. They show off everything that the violin has to offer, you know, beautiful melodies and lots of interesting pyrotechnics, and it's fun for the orchestra too. You know, it has this kind of Spanish flair, and it works very well with the Ravel Rhapsody Espagnole that starts the program.
And you've worked with Maestro Dutoit before?
Yeah, we've known each other for quite a long time. I'm thinking it's been about 18 years that we've been working together, so it's we've developed a very close working relationship over the years. He's one of my favorite conductors to play for, so it is always a pleasure.
Among your honors is the 2005 Avery Fisher Career Grant. Now, what does that career grant entail?
Money. it was, let's see, how to put it in a nicer way. Well, it did provide a nice check because, you know, when you're starting earlier in your career, there's a lot of expenses involved. You hope to be able to, of course, make a living, but instruments are expensive, bows are expensive, and you might want to invest in certain aspects of one's career. And the Avery Fisher Career Grant
allows you the luxury to just
right, focus exactly, on that. To focus on a particular project. And for me, the project at that time was a recording of Mozart's complete violin concertos that I was putting on myself. And so the record label paid for most of it, but that Avery Fisher Career Grant also helped.
Very nice. I understand you have quite an extraordinary violin at your disposal. Now, how did you come by the instrument you play on? Tell us about it.
Well, it's a 1715 Stradivarius that's known as the Marsic after a former player, Martin-Pierre Marsic, who was one of the great virtuosos of the late 19th, early 20th centuries. It's a very long story, my history with this violin, but to make it very short, I first saw it in, I think it was November of 96, and I fell in love immediately, and it took several years to figure out a way to sort of secure it for my use, and it was very fortunate that it was bought by a collector, a friend of mine, a philanthropist, fellow musician man named David Fulton, who has an extraordinary collection of instruments, and he loaned it to me for many, many years, and eventually made it available for me to buy back from him at a very ridiculously low price, which was still more money than I have, but that's what I work for, right?
Exactly.
I need a few more of those Avery Fisher grants.
Yeah. Is that your exclusive instrument now to use?
It is. For me, it's a violin that can do anything. That's my favorite thing about it, is it really It does what you tell it to, and I've yet to want to make a sound that I haven't eventually figured out how to do on that instrument. I think that these really great violins are the ones that have just almost limitless possibilities, and it's, I guess, a good thing to, if there's something I want to do and it's not happening, I can't blame my equipment. You know, there are no excuses. I always think, well, the violin is probably better than I am, so I will just continue to try to find the most interesting and beautiful and different sounds in it that I can.
I'm talking with James Ennis, who is soloist with the San Francisco Symphony this week. James, it's interesting you should say that about the Stradivarius, because my previous guest, Gene Johnson, performs on a Baroque instrument. Mm-hmm. And these instruments were really intended for smaller concert halls. And apparently most of the instruments that are dating from this period have been retooled somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's an interesting thing that the Stradivari was one of the first makers to understand that the future of music was going to be moving into larger spaces, and he was very concerned with the issue of projection and worked throughout his life refining his models and sometimes changing his models quite dramatically in an effort to create a bigger sound, which at the time was really not considered that important. And it was really quite a while, I mean several generations after Stradivari's death, before his instruments became really the most coveted by players. During his lifetime, they were coveted to a certain degree by players, but they were just such magnificent works of art. You know, he was often being commissioned by noble families and royalty. He became a very wealthy man, but his understanding of where the music world was going was really quite extraordinary. And when these instruments were kind of tweaked to basically make for bigger sounds in bigger rooms, it was Stradivari instruments and Guarneri instruments that responded to this much better than some of the other instruments of the day that were prioritized to have maybe more sweetness. Though the real glory of a Strad is that it has this incredible refined beauty and sweetness of sound, while also a carrying projection that works in larger concert halls.
Speaking of concert halls, now tonight you're going to be performing at the New Green Center at Sonoma State University, which I'm told has got an extraordinary acoustic. You've performed in, I'd say, most of the world's most acclaimed concert halls. Do you have a favorite hall? We won't hold it against you if you don't say Davies. That's all right.
Well, I do like Davies. I've had a lot of great times playing in Davies. You know, there are so many nice places to play, nice in different ways, and it's so difficult to compare halls of different sizes. I mean, small halls, ultimately, you know, as we were just discussing, you know, the violin is not by its nature an instrument that is best suited to a 3,000-seat concert hall. So the halls that are best for the violin tend to be a little bit smaller, and I think that maybe from a violinist's perspective, the big halls that are most remarkable are the ones that work as if they were small halls. You know, a place like Wigmore Hall in London is incredible for the violin. It's kind of perfect and ideal, but of course it's only a few hundred seats. Then you get the Musikverein, and that's, what, maybe 1,600 seats in Vienna.
In Vienna, yeah.
And that's also fabulous and amazing, and on the violin you can do just about anything. But a place that really, and I know everybody says this, but it really is true, the place that's absolutely amazing is Carnegie, because it's, I think, 2,700 or 2,800 seats, but you can play like it's a 400-seat recital hall. It's an amazing thing. I don't really quite understand how that place worked out to be just as great as it is, but it's a joy to play there.
Now, I wish you all the best of luck initiating this new concert hall for your performance base. I hope it all works out well. Now, I understand you have a Bartok project you've been working on.
Yeah, I've been involved in a Bartok recording project for Shandos, and we have just released, or are just releasing. I'm kind of confused as to when the exact U.S. release date is. I know it's out in a lot of places already, but it's the third of these Bartok discs, which is actually the second volume of the violin and piano works. The first volume was the two violin concertos and the viola concerto. The second volume was the two famous sonatas for violin and piano and the two rhapsodies for violin and piano. This disc is the solo violin sonata, which is arguably one of his greatest masterpieces, a very early violin sonata for violin and piano that's a fascinating glimpse of Bartok before his immersion in the folk music that became such a massive part of his musical personality. And the CD also has on it various collections of folk songs that Bartok did with some of his violinist buddies over the years.
We're going to hear an excerpt from that in just a moment, but I want to thank you for coming in and sharing a little bit of time in between your performances.
Oh, pleasure.
James.
Nice to be here.
And enjoy your stay in San Francisco.
Thank you.
What do you think of this town?
Oh, it's great. I love coming here. I would be very fat if I came here all the time. I love the food. It's just outstanding.
Violinist James Ennis, who performed last night with the San Francisco Symphony in Davies Hall. He'll have another performance there tomorrow. And tonight, the San Francisco Symphony performs at the New Green Music Center at Sonoma State University. Again, this program, under the baton of guest conductor Charles Dutoit, includes Elgar's Enigma Variations, Ravel's Rhapsody Espagnole, and violinist James Ennis as soloist for Lalo's Symphonie Espagnole. For more information about the concert, visit sfsymphony.org. Here now is Music of Bartok, soon to be released, featuring violinist James Ennis. music of Bartok, soon to be released by my guest, James Ennis. Bartok Romanian folk dance with pianist Andrew Armstrong, soon to be on the Shandos label. James being the soloist with the San Francisco Symphony. More information about those concerts at sfsymphony.org. Speaking of the San Francisco Symphony, I'm going to encourage you to visit their Facebook page to enjoy a fun rivalry that's going on between the San Francisco Symphony and the Baltimore Symphony leading up to the Super Bowl. On that page, you'll see a photo of San Francisco Symphony harpist Doug Rioth showing off his tats, a la Colin Kaepernick, oboist Bill Bennett and clarinetist Luis Baez diagramming the reed option a la playbook style, and percussionist Trey Wyatt about to smash a couple of stuffed ravens between his cymbals. Now, I'm not a football fan, but I do feel obliged to offer some auditory proof of the vast superiority of the San Francisco Symphony in the land of the 49ers to the symphony where the Ravens nest. I mean, just listen to this secretly obtained field recording of the Baltimore Symphony in rehearsal. Now, to even think that our multiple Grammy Award-winning San Francisco Symphony is in the same league, NFL or otherwise, is just ludicrous. So, in contrast, enjoy this auditory battle, the death of Tybalt. Let's call it the death of Raven quarterback Joe Placco, from the Grammy-winning recording of Michael Tilson Thomas conducting his arrangement in an excerpt from Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet. Death of the Ravens, the death of Tybalt, from the Grammy Award-winning recording of the San Francisco Symphony, music of Prokofiev. Actually, that earlier recording was not really the Baltimore Symphony. Diane Keogh joining me now. I think she was chuckling at the inadequacy of that performance. That was actually from a PDQ Bach recording. So,
okay. Right.
I'm sure the Baltimore Symphony sounds better. In fact, the former principal flutist of the Baltimore Symphony, Tim Day, is now the principal flutist of the San Francisco Symphony. So,
well, it's a small world, I
there's
guess.
There's a coinky-dinky.
Yeah.
So Diane's here to offer some reviews and some picks for some things that are coming up.
A couple of things. The first thing, tying in with symphony, I just wanted to mention again the concert program January 18th for the Peninsula Symphony, which was tango. And it was, I know that it's been talked about and you were involved with it, and it was a lot of interesting stuff. It was also beautiful music that I never knew existed because of the reason that it came about. Some of the things that happened, of course, they had two wonderful tango dancers on stage doing, I don't know how they did some of the things they did. It was a fun evening, but it was also a very educational evening, and it was very enjoyable by everybody. And I don't think that the Peninsula Symphony gets enough kudos for who they are and what they do, and you're being part of it. I know you don't want to talk about it, but I just had to mention it, so there.
You're very kind. Another great program coming up in March. It's music of Brahms, Hindemith, and a wonderful soloist playing Dvorak's cello concerto. So go to peninsulasymphony.org to learn more about our program.
And
there.
I will be there.
Great.
And then one other thing I had to talk about. January 3rd in Belmont, the Carlmont High School had a program by the Fizzwinks. Now, the Fizzwinks are the junior and lower classmen at Yale. They are precursor to being a Whiffenpoof, I guess, as it may be. There are 18 of them. They are a choral group that marched out on stage in white tie and tails. And the reason that they were at the small school in Belmont is because that they try to do is to take their organization to every town that one of their members is from. And this young man who was in there had been in music doing middle school and high school there. So they all came out in their white tie and tails, except the fellow who was from the hometown. Everyone had on black shoes. He had on red high tops. So, okay. So we knew who he was. They did wonderful. They did a wonderful program, just all kinds of wonderful choral music. But they also introduced themselves with a very humorous thing. They each stood up and talked what they were going to be, what they studied, and what they wanted to be. And one of them was going to be, he was going to study astronomy and archaeology because he wanted to be a rock star. And the other one, okay. This one is really so true. He was going to go to theater arts and music and dance because he was going to be a waiter.
Yeah. Oh, well.
And that rings very true.
Punny and true. Very. Okay.
Yeah, it was really quite an enjoyable evening. I just wanted to throw that in because it was so much fun.
What's been going on the theater front?
Oh, wow. Well, let's see. I just spent Tuesday night with earplugs going to see Rock of Ages at the San Jose Performing Arts Center. Sold out house. Absolutely sold out house. And so many people were so involved in it that they were having their hands up in the air and standing up and enjoying it. However, the lady sitting next to me played symphony harp, and she had her earplugs in, and she got up and left after the first act. It was very loud. It was very, very loud. But it was a Broadway show.
Rock of Ages.
Hmm?
Rock of Ages.
Rock of Ages with everybody in it that was, they had so much energy on stage. It was wonderful to watch them. The dancing, the choreography was great, if a bit redundant. And other than that, I think that anyone who enjoyed music from the 80s would enjoy the show. And it's going to be there through Sunday. And then it'll be gone because, the Broadway shows come and go very quickly down there. But I think that they might enjoy it, and the tickets are still available until on Sunday. Then there was Somewhere, which was a Theater Works production at Lucy Stern, and it will be there through February 10th. It's the story of a Puerto Rican family in the 1980s who wanted to all be dancers, and they lived in an area which we all know is Lincoln Center right now, but it was torn down and they were going to have to leave the house, and the mother, the two sons, the daughter, and the family friend. And they were all very good actors and dancers, but I really wanted to pop the mother over the head because she refused to see what was coming and she refused to do what she was told to do.
Well, you might know the story of that very land where Lincoln Center was where they filmed some of West Side Story.
Yes, and they found out about this, and so the mother wanted them all to go try out for parts. And the whole story is basically about that. And the one young man who was the older son, the husband had gone down to South America, and so she was left with the three children. And the eldest son was a great dancer, and she kept wanting him to do it, but he, in the meantime, was taking a job to support the family, so he really couldn't do it. But there was one wonderful scene in it where they had the scenery break away, and the background was nothing but stars, and the young man danced. And it was very much like Chorus Line, with the mirror and the music and me. It was a beautifully done dance. And the dances, though not many, were excellent during the entire show. It's at Lucy Stern. It's called Somewhere. And it will be there through February 10th.
Great. Well, you have one more pick that we can share? Something coming up that you're looking forward to? Or?
You know, the Cartoon Jazz Orchestra.
Of course, yes.
We'll be
playing Eric Wayne
tomorrow night at Stanford.
Nice.
At 7:30. And I'm trying to try to go, but I always get lost on the Stanford campus.
Even with GPS these days, maybe you need a smarter phone.
I don't have GPS.
You need a smarter phone, Diane. That's all there is to it.
But anyway, I want to mention one thing. Silver Linings Playbook, excellent movie. It's gotten big pans and big kudos, so go and see it. I think that everybody's talking about Les Mis. It was way too long. And poor Russell Crowe, great actor, cannot sing.
Oh, my gosh. If I was the director, I would have said, quite frankly, Russell, let's do another take, shall we?
It wouldn't matter. And it seemed to rain a lot. It rained through the entire performance almost in that movie, except in one scene when two people were talking, it was raining on her and it wasn't raining on him until the camera angle changed.
Are you saying you wanted it less miserable, Diane?
Less. It was way too long.
It was a bit miserable.
And I hope it doesn't really take away from the other movies that are out there that are kind of really good, like Lincoln, which was great.
Sure, well.
And so I guess that's all I have time to talk about.
Indeed. I thank you for stopping by this week.
Thanks for having me. It's been fun.
Of course. I should mention that KLW continues its exclusive partnership with the Berklee Symphony this Sunday and Monday for a broadcast that was recorded in Zellerbach Hall in December. That was dedicated to longtime host here at KLW, Alan Farley. You'll hear an onstage dedication for that. Music director Joanna Carnero leads the symphony in Robert Schumann's Symphony No. 2, Ligeti's Piano Concerto with Shai Wozner as soloist, and the world premiere of Berklee native Dylan Mattingly's Invisible Skyline. I'll be hosting the broadcast. I hope you'll join me Sunday at 4 in the afternoon, and we'll rebroadcast that Monday at 9 p.m. That's Open Air for this week. My thanks to producer Niels Swinkels for assistance on this week's show. Next week, I'll be talking with San Jose Opera assistant conductor Andrew Whitfield and Nicole Paimont of Ensemble Parallèle. Hard to believe, but it's also the first Thursday of the month next week, February 7th. So as a new feature, Joshua Cosman will be joining me for a look at the month ahead in classical music. I'm David LaTulipe. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.